Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. How to live with the brain of a caveman in the 21st century is the subject of this edition of Radio Curious. We visit with Rick Hansen, PhD, a neuropsychologist and meditation teacher. He's the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. This book explains brain functions and how they affect our attitudes and happiness. It presents coherent and practical skills of positive psychology that employ tenets of Buddhism. Dr. Hansen and I visited by phone from his home in San Rafael, California, on June 11, 2012. We began when I asked him ways to live in modern society with a brain that evolved over millions of years in order to function well in our former hunter-gatherer societies.
A short way to put it is that what do we do with the caveman brain in the 21st century? I think you're getting at an extremely important point, which is to, how can I put it, ground our thinking about what it means to be human, or to ground literally how we help ourselves cope and thrive in daily life in the reality of our own bodies, which are the result of 3.5 billion years of life's evolution and 600 million years of the evolution of the nervous system, and, you know, 30 or so million years of primate evolution, and then 2.5 million years or so of evolution of tool manufacturing hominids. And as you point out, about 150 or so thousand years of evolution in genetically modern humans. So we're very shaped by that evolution. And one of the ways that we're shaped by it is that the good news is that the resting state of the human brain is a good place. We when we're not disturbed, our body and our brain goes to what I call the responsive mode, where the body repairs and refuels itself. And in our mind, we feel essentially, basically, peaceful, happy, and loving. That's the good news. That's where most people go when they're not disturbed by threat or disappointment or loss, or by feeling rejected and unloved. That's the good news. That's our home base. That's the essence of our true nature in a neuropsychological, biological sense. The bad news is that, as you're kind of implying, we also have this capacity in us, Mother Nature has endowed us with, to help our ancestors survive, where the brain can very rapidly tip into what's called its reactive mode, where we expend resources, we rev up the fight-or-flight stress response sympathetic wing of the nervous system. Stress hormones course through our bodies, and in the mind, we tip into a state where we feel basically threatened or disappointed or frustrated or unloved or rejected or dismissed or discounted as a person. And a lot of these reactive states are relatively mild, but they become chronic, and they wear down on our physical and mental health over the long term, and they wear down on our daily well-being, and they obstruct personal growth, and if that's of interest to a person, spiritual practice. And at the global level, they drive the whole red state, blue state craziness in America today, and they cause people to feel excessively and needlessly threatened by others, and they cause people to be greedy and do things like, you know, drive the engine of global warming. So long and the short of it for me is to look for ways to use the mind to change the brain to gradually over time help us get out of the reactive mode and stabilize and stay in the responsive mode, which is the fundamental basis of personal healing and well-being, healthy relationships, and a sustainable and peaceful world.
Let's stay with the development of those forms of the brain and discuss the kinds of memories that we have, explicit and implicit, the ones that we remember, the ones that are just under our radar, if not significantly buried by it.
Yeah, well, the essential idea here is found in the saying in neuroscience, neurons that fire together, wire together. In other words, how we use the mind is continually sculpting the brain. Literally, repeated habits of how we think, what we feel, our reactions to things, the desires we enact, all that is continually changing brain structure. The only question really is that structure changing for better or worse? This changing of the structure of the brain is learning, or to use synonymous word, essentially, is memory. Now, most of that memory, most of the learning or structural change in the brain happens below the level of awareness, and that's the realm, essentially, of implicit memory.
Can you give us some examples of below the level of awareness?
Yeah. Explicit memory are recollections of specific events, like what you had for breakfast this morning or what you did last summer, or knowledge of facts like what's the capital of California. Implicit memory includes what's called procedural memory, knowledge how to, like how to ride a bike, or literally how to walk, or how to interact with someone who is prickly. I mean, or how to plan your day. That's procedural memory. Another major aspect of implicit memory is mood. It's the gradual internalization of the emotional experiences that we have and the ways that they leave residues in the atmosphere of the brain. Also, implicit memory includes our expectations, our assumptions, our biases, how we frame things, how we tend to see stuff, and all the rest of that. Well, you can see right there that where the action really is implicit memory, and what my book, Buddhist Brain, is so much about is research-based methods whereby people in ordinary ways in the middle of life can use specific mental activities to restructure the implicit memory systems in their brain and tilt them toward a more positive mood, a more optimistic outlook, more inner peace, more sense of inner strength, greater resilience, and so forth by using their mind alone, which is pretty cool, I think, these days.
I think it's important to discuss the implicit memories that we develop as children. Our first experience in food is what we compare subsequent experiences to, and our developed likes or dislikes. Our first experience in being loved is what we learn as a way of being loved, whether it's abusive attention from a parent or loving, caring attention.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that with some development child's brain develops?
Well, you're getting at a very important point, which is the plasticity, as it were. That's the fancy word for the capacity of the brain to change itself. The plasticity of the brain is greatest when we're youngest. It continues throughout the entire lifespan. I mean, literally, we are capable of changing the structure of our brain for the better up through our last breath. Literally, which I find personally haunting and profound and inspiring. But the brain is most plastic, to be sure, when we're very, very young. So experiences when we're young can have a lasting impact. I think the takeaway from that is minimally, one, to have compassion and understanding with regard to oneself about the impact of one's childhood. I'm a practicing therapist as well as a writer and so on. And as a therapist, I'll routinely have people say to me that they feel bad about the fact that they're still affected by their childhood. But of course you're affected because the brain is a learning organ. You learned things when you were young. The second takeaway is that it's really possible to change that learning. In other words, to unlearn what's no longer helpful and to learn things that would be. I mean, for example, people can use the methods I get into on taking in the good, where they specifically focus on key positive experiences and stay with them one or two dozen seconds at a time so that they're forced into the structure of the brain. And, for example, today a person could really focus on everyday small experiences of being seen or liked or included or appreciated or even loved and deliberately savor them, relish them, feel them in a whole-body kind of way. Not the concept of being loved, but the experience of being loved, and thereby internalize those experiences gradually down into the hurt places inside where maybe as a kid, she or he was not sufficiently loved or appropriately loved or loved in all the right ways.
Let's talk about the concept, tell me how you were loved, and I will tell you how you love someone else. Maybe you can add some specific examples.
Well, there's a lot of research that shows that, for example, our attachment paradigms or models, how our sense of attachment and security of attachment as a child can influence us as adults. On the other hand, the truth is that if you think of the pie chart of causes that shape how we love others as adults, Only one slice of that pie is how we were loved when we were young. It's an influential slice. And for some people, it's a really huge slice of the pie. But on average, that slice of the pie of causes of how we love today is a tiny fraction of the whole pie, which is very hopeful. And let me be clear here. I'm a therapist, like I said, and I've grappled with my own issues from childhood. I'm not trying to diminish whatsoever the impact of what happens for people. And I'm a very strong advocate for rearing children with, and I've, you know, walked that talk, for rearing children with enormous care and sensitivity and nurturance and all the rest of it. That said, humans are very resilient, and there are many, many doors we can walk through in our teens and then especially in our adulthood whereby we can heal and recover from deficits or wounds from our own childhood. I mean, for example, there's a lot of research that shows that if people work at it as adults, they can heal from or recover from insecure attachment structures in childhood, and they can love very fully and well today, which I think goes to the larger point, which is that it's both wonderfully hopeful that we actually can, through mental efforts and skillful practices alone, literally a handful of minutes every day. I'm not talking about running off to a monastery. But it's hopeful and wonderful that through a few minutes of focused and skillful effort a day, we can gradually heal ourselves. We can gradually absorb and build up really wonderful capacities inside ourselves and inclinations of mind and heart. It's not just hopeful, but it takes us to responsibility. That it's on us to do that work.
I'd like you to talk about the mental efforts and skillful practices that we can develop. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Rick Hansen, who's the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Rick, in creating those efforts and developing those skills, from my observation that there are different ages of adulthood. Obviously, older adolescents and young adults have less of a life experience, so they're more dependent on what may be beneficial or not so beneficial childhood experiences. From what I've read and listening to you talk, those mental efforts in developing the practices don't really matter the age. So tell us about the efforts, practices, how to do it.
The brain is really complicated, but fundamentally it's really simple. It's a lot like a muscle. If you don't use a muscle, it will atrophy and kind of wither away and get weaker. On the other hand, or if you strain a muscle and you hurt it, it'll be affected. On the other hand, if you work that muscle in good ways, particularly repeatedly and over periods of time, you will strengthen that muscle. And when you strengthen that muscle, it will have more capacity. It'll be able to do more good things for you and the whole wide world. So that's the fundamental idea. And the capacity of the brain as, in a sense, a muscle to improve itself lasts throughout the lifespan. So the opportunity is really, really there. But this kind of goes to my personal experience of being a therapist a long time. It's made me more compassionate, but in a sense, it's made me tougher because I've really come to appreciate that with regard to our thoughts, our feelings, our moods, our desires, we have to earn the results we want. In other words, as in any area of life, we have to do the work. And I'm routinely struck by people who will put a lot of effort into getting better at things that they will tell you don't matter that much to them, and yet they'll put very little effort, relatively, into things that they will tell you matter a lot, like being a better parent or a better mate or getting more skillful with managing their own thoughts and feelings, desires, and other reactions. And so the good news is that if we just expend, you know, a handful of minutes every day in a focused kind of way, using practices like in my books or in other good resources out there in the world, like some of the interviews you've got posted on your great website, if they just make those efforts, if we just make these efforts, we will change things for the better. But on the other hand, it's on us to make those efforts, and we can't blame anybody else if we don't make them ourselves.
Can you describe the steps in the practices that you refer to?
Yeah, let me give you, if I could, two examples. of little things people can do in everyday life. I mean, I've done long practices myself, and I think there's no replacement for example, a week of retreat of one kind or another. But on the other hand, most people, me included, are very busy. We've got full lives. We're going to do stuff kind of on the fly, and that's the sort of thing I'm really interested in. The first goes to my point up in the very beginning about the distinction between the responsive and the reactive modes of the brain. It's kind of like two settings, the green setting for responsive, the red setting for reactive. And one great way to get out of the reactive mode, when you start feeling kind of stressed, irritated, frazzled, anxious, rattled, got too much to do, too much multitasking, pulled in too many different directions, too many balls in the air, that will actually activate the same machinery that our ancestors evolved to get away from charging lions. And it sends the same stress hormones coursing through the blood that have the same negative consequences. So a good way to deal with that, take three or more really long exhalations, exhalations that are about twice as long as your inhalation. Technically, what that will do is when you exhale, you're using the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system, which is the quote-unquote rest and digest wing of the nervous system. That's very repairing and refueling for us, and it's the antidote to the fight-or-flight sympathetic wing of the nervous system, the stress response wing of the nervous system. So three or more long exhalations will immediately bring the needle of your personal stressometer back out of the red zone, at least into orange, if not yellow or green.
I want to comment there that that also reduces blood pressure related to what you're describing.
Yeah, that's great. Excellent point. The body, it's a mind-body connection, so great. The second thing you can do routinely is what I call taking in the good, which has three simple steps. I'll name them here. One is to have a good experience in the first place, either by noticing that you're having one or look for the basis for one. Like, for example, look for things to be grateful for or look for evidence of your own good qualities or, you know, pay attention when other people are reasonably nice to you, not a big deal, or when you get something done. You know, really bring your awareness to it so you can activate a good experience based on a good fact. Okay, that's step one. Have a good experience. Step two, here's the important part. Stay with it. Extend that experience in space and time. In other words, feel it in your body and really let it last a dozen or more seconds. There's kind of a threshold whereby if we're below that threshold, the positive experience flows through the brain like water through a sieve. We have to stay with it 10, 20 seconds in a row to get it to transfer from short-term memory buffers to long-term emotional storage. Whereas, by contrast, negative experiences get fast-tracked immediately in the long-term storage. That's why I say the brain's like Velcro for negative experiences, but Teflon for positive ones. So to defeat this negativity bias of the brain, which is what scientists call it, one great way to do it in the second step of taking in the good is to really savor those positive experiences. And then in the third step, kind of sense and intend that the positive experience is sinking into you, like water into a sponge, or with kids I'll talk about a jewel in a treasure chest of the heart. Not a deal. The whole thing lasts less than 30 seconds. With practice, it's about 10 to 20 seconds or even less. But if you do that half a dozen times a day, deliberately, where you just stay with something up to 30 seconds at a time, 3 minutes total in a day, right, you will gradually change your brain for the better.
Can you relate this to Buddha and the followers of Buddha?
Oh, that's a very deep and interesting question. I'd be happy to do that. You know, my own background is trained in Buddhism, but I'm not trying to privilege it. I mean, I think that there's a lot of wisdom there that is matched by, of course, wisdom in other great contemplative traditions or even secular traditions. That said, the Buddha never claimed, unlike most world teachers, he never claimed any supernatural factors. He didn't speak of himself as a prophet. He didn't describe himself as the Son of God. I mean, he basically always described himself as a human being who, through dint of very focused effort, was able to attain the highest reaches of human potential in terms of full awakening, full enlightenment. And so I think to myself, the Buddha had a human brain. If he could do it in his brain, others can do it too. And in fact, many others have attained, I think, full awakening in history or have gone a long way down that road. So what I'm interested in part, is reverse engineering. In other words, taking particularly his earliest teachings and the surviving record of them in a good translation, they're very psychological. They're not metaphysical, almost any of them. They're very, very psychological. I do the reverse engineering. I think to myself, huh, he's talking about mental factors or states of mind. All right. What is the neurology? What are the underlying physical neurological processes that underlie those mental states? Okay. And now, how can we reach into the black box of the brain through mental activity alone and activate those neural states? How can we stimulate them, which therefore means strengthening them, so we gradually change the brain for the better? So I look at the Dharma, Buddhism, essentially as a roadmap that's very grounded in the real world. It's grounded in human psychology, neurology, and evolutionary biology. And grounded in those things, it tells us that in very concrete and material ways, we truly can change the brain for the better. And, you know, as part of that, too, I'm really interested in learning how to steady the mind, because attention, you know, mindfulness and attention is the doorway to changing the brain for the better, because the brain changes especially for what we focus on.
You talk about full awakening. Can you describe what that is? And I realize that could well be a double-edged sword. Somebody could say, oh, that's my goal. And other people would say, I can never reach that goal. But describe full awakening for us.
In Buddhism, full awakening is operationalized as, it's defined as essentially a mind in which greed, hatred, and delusion no longer arise, or basically they no longer invade the mind and remain. So if you think about it, that's a very psychological definition of enlightenment. It means a mind basically that has found what the Buddha said is the highest happiness, which is peace. It's no longer disturbed by negative reactions to things that are unpleasant. It's no longer disturbed by grasping and chasing and wanting, my precious, you know, things that are pleasant. And it is no longer at all confused about the fundamental nature of things, which is that they're endlessly changing and endlessly interdependent, so nothing has any absolute self-existence. And in that state of mind, and people who seem to embody it or are close to it, there's just a profound inner peace and happiness and love and engagement with the world to help it make a better place. So to me, that's very concretely defined. Now, in some other traditions, they bring in the divine. And I happen myself to be a theist. I think there really is a transcendental X factor embedded into the nature of things, etc. And so for them, full awakening is more a matter of God realization. But really, for me, these two models of awakening, the theistic one and the one that's agnostic about the divine, which is the Buddhist one, actually intersect, because in a sense what full awakening is from a Buddhist standpoint is absolute transparency for the possibility of the divine to shine through. You know, there are a lot of intermediate stages between being, you know, a Woody Allen level neurotic and Buddha, and or wherever you want, you know, full awakening enlightenment. I put myself in that intermediate place along the path, and along the path, the path becomes its own reward. I mean, it, you know, different kinds of frustrations and reactive patterns fall away. One starts taking life less personally. Attention starts getting freed up from one's, you know, intense, driven, negative reactions. We see the world more fully. Our capacity to experience joy and pleasure increases. It's a very pleasurable path in many, many ways. There's less and less sense of I. There's more and more capacity to love and open out into we. To the point that, you know, quoting Dogen, the great Zen master, one becomes enlightened by all things. One becomes more opened out and lived by this beautiful world we live in. So that's a pretty good path, you know. It's what Jack Kornfield calls a path with heart.
You also talk about life as a narrow bridge. Getting across that bridge is its own reward. And I kind of interpret life as a narrow bridge, connecting the eternity prior to birth to the eternity after death.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful. I think, at least as far as we know, this is our, as Mary Oliver puts it, and you put it too, our one wild and precious life. And Who knows what came before? Who knows what comes after? But we know that we've got this one wild and precious life. What shall we do with it? And for me, I think the essence of modern science and the essence of the contemplative traditions, you know, including the one I'm trained in, Buddhism, is to be clear-eyed about the way it really is. It's the truth that sets us free, as it says in the Bible. And ultimately, I think that if we're present in life as it is, we see both its beauty and its extraordinary opportunity. And we start realizing more and more that if we cling to anything in the mind whatsoever, we just set ourselves up and others for suffering and harm.
Well, Rick Hansen, author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness and Love, I thank you for being with us on Radio Curious, and I'd like to ask about you. An aha or eureka moment, perhaps an epiphany that you live by.
I had a moment in my late 20s. You know, I'd been partying too hard. I'd been stressed out by work. I'd been just kind of caught up in the hurly-burly reactive roller coaster. And I found myself looking in the mirror, and I could see in my face already in my late 20s the residues of being off track, strain, stress, weariness, confusion. And I realized that if I didn't really direct myself in a better way, I was going to be going down the wrong road. But I think every day is an opportunity for a significant course correction.
Well, let me ask you then, what would you like to do with the rest of your wild and precious life?
My bet, a lot. Over the next, 10 years, we'll be very zeroed in on how to sustain a vision of the positive possible and how to routinely use the power of positive experiences to gradually change the brain for the better and draw a critical mass of human brains out of the habit of reactivity and draw a critical mass of human brains into a fundamental grounding in the responsive mode of the human brain.
And finally, Rick Hansen, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
Satipatthana, Satipatthana, Satipatthana. It's by a German monk named Analayo. Analayo. What it is an incredibly clear and succinct book about the four foundations of mindfulness practice in Buddhism, the actual what you're supposed to do that will take you to full awakening.
Well, Rick Hansen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Well, Barry Vogel, it's a pleasure to be here, and I wish you and everyone else listening well.
Dr. Rick Hansen is a neuropsychologist and meditation teacher and the author of Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom. The book he recommends is Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization by Analayo. This interview was recorded on June 11th, 2012. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. Janet Mendel, a Radio Curious assistant producer, participated in the development of this program. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.